Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Gavin Lurson. But first of all, there's a lot of controversy going around about YouTube not including advertising on channels with less than 10,000 views. And there's a big furor over this, mostly because everyone's saying, look at all the advertising revenue that the artists aren't getting. But here's what everyone's missing. It's 10,000 views total on all of the videos on a channel, not 10,000 subscribers. 10,000 subscribers is pretty tough to get to, but that's not the milestone. The milestone is 10,000 views total. Now look, in the grand scheme of things, 10,000 views is nothing. Really, even 1 million views isn't all that big a deal, and I think you'll find even indie record labels will begin to say, pay attention when we get to 8 figures. Until you get to about 50 million views, really, you're not doing much on YouTube. And again, the scale of everything is way different than it used to be. So 10,000 views is nothing. If you can't get to 10,000 views, boy, you don't have an audience at all. What this is at 10,000 views, you're allowed to join the YouTube Partner Program. And that's when you can begin to share revenue. If you're already in the partner program and you don't have 10,000 views, it's okay. You're going to be grandfathered in, so it's no big deal. But again, if you only have 10,000 views, you're not making much anyway, because 10,000 views is, like I say, a drop in the bucket. So it's a good thing to learn to readjust the way you look at these things when it comes to streaming and views, because 1 million just isn't what it used to be, and 10,000 is way, 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 way less than it used to be. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Mixing Primer webinar course. Go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. Also check out my new Hitmakers Club for access to all my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to thehitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Now, if you're a Mac user, and your digital audio workstation is built around a Mac, then this is for you. All of us know that the last Mac Pro that was released, the trash can, as everyone calls it, was 2013, and definitely an update is really in order. And because nothing was coming from Apple, they haven't done anything with that particular model for 4 years, the speculation was that Apple was going to abandon the pros, abandon that particular model, and abandon maybe desktops in general. However, Apple did something that was pretty unique for them last week. They had a meeting in one of their secret research labs in which they had the EVP of Worldwide Marketing, Phil Schiller, as well as the VPs of Hardware and Software. And what they did is they brought in a small group of journalists, and they basically had a heart-to-heart talk with them about the state of the Mac Pro and what's going to happen. One of the interesting things that we found out from this is there are 100 million Mac users worldwide, and it's a $25 billion business. It can be a Fortune 100 company just on its own. 80% of those are MacBooks, and Mac Pro sales are actually up 20% this year. That being said, Apple acknowledged that the number of Pro users is probably in the single digits. And really, there's no one type of pro user. We tend to think just about audio, and of course, video people tend to think just about video. But in fact, there are graphics professionals and programmers and scientists and architects and all sorts of other pros that use the Mac. And guess what? We're all looking forward to a brand new one. And it looks like that's going to happen. They said they're going to come out with something modular, maybe by the end of the year, but everyone thinks it's going to be more like 2018. They kind of acknowledged that the trash can Mac Pro was more form over function. It looks great. It does one thing really great, which is get rid of heat. But the fact of the matter is, it's very difficult to upgrade, if not impossible, and really have lots and lots of cables and everything hanging off of it. So it wasn't, when it comes down to it, the best unit for a pro. But Apple says they're going to change things and we're going to see something new pretty soon. This is really unusual because Apple doesn't telegraph these things. It's one of those things where all of a sudden you wake up one day and you find out there's something new, or they say there's going to be a press conference or an event that's going to happen in 2 weeks or a week, and then they announce it. But in this case, they've announced it way in advance. They also said that the current Trash Can Mac is going to get a speed bump pretty soon, so it actually is going to be updated for the first time, upgraded, I should say. And also, there's supposed to be some new iMacs coming out. A lot of us have gone over to iMacs because we get the ports we want and the big screen, and it seems to work for a lot of people. But if you're in the market for a new Mac Pro, if you can hold on for a little while, it's probably going to be best. Gavin Lurson started as a protege of the great Doug Sachs, but quickly forged his own way, first at the famed Mastering Lab, then at his own Lurson Mastering in Hollywood. Along the way, he's mastered projects for everyone from the Foo Fighters to Queens of the Stone Age, Eric Clapton, Sheryl Crow, Miranda Lambert, and Elvis Costello, among many, many, many others. Plus, he's won 5 Grammy Awards for his work. Gavin is also on the board of directors of the Recording Academy and now has his own mastering plugin from IK Multimedia. I spoke with Gavin live from a studio in Burbank, California. I know you started with Doug Sachs, and I want to hear about that, but let's go back before that, because you were a Berkeley guy, right?
I was, yeah. I studied film scoring at Berklee College of Music. I tried to get into the engineering program, and they had such stringent requirements. And a lot of it had to do with your high schooling. And I didn't take my schooling seriously till I went to college. So I had to actually go to community college for a couple of years before I could build up enough credibility to get into a place like Berklee. So, you know, that around the time I went to community college, I started to figure out that I wanted to be in the music business, you know. And so I went to Berklee. Within a year, I applied for the engineering. They told me I couldn't get in. And it's a sort of a running joke now because I'm pretty good friends with the crew that runs that department. And it's looked back on with a chuckle, you know. But what's great is I studied film composition, you know, film music. And my instrument was guitar. So I got a really great, well-rounded education in all aspects, but in how music is made and composed and all that, you know. And everything I would have learned at Berklee, I probably have learned on the job by now, you know. So that was great. And when I graduated in 91, I wasn't sure where to go with that degree. I didn't really... You know, I thought it would be cool to be a film scorer or a TV composer or something like that, but I didn't have, you know, that deep down gut feeling. Mm. I didn't see myself as that. I knew that would be a great education to open doors for certain aspects of the music industry. But degree in hand and my mom's borrowed car, we lived in Virginia at the time, just outside of D.C., I convinced her... to let me borrow her car for 1 year, and I would then return it. So that would allow me to drive to LA and grab a job in the music business. So I never actually ended up returning that car. she still rides me about that. But obviously she wanted to support that cause, you know. So I drove out. I knew one person in LA, and it was before cell phones. So, and GPS and all that stuff. Yep. So I kind of had a map, you know. I loosely planned it. I had 7...
Thomas Guide, right?
I didn't even have that because I was getting to LA. Thomas Guide is an LA thing, you know.
Yeah.
So I went to AAA, you know, and I got the maps and they highlighted the areas. And I actually still have a map that I used to drive across the country where I marked all my stopping points and... you know, how much I'd spent on gas, you know, just kind of a map, knowing one day that would be fun to look back on that.
Yeah.
So I arrived in LA, and I remember being on the 101 freeway just outside of downtown, and I knew kind of sort of where my friend lived, and he roughly knew when I was going to arrive in LA, you know. I couldn't reach him on the cell or anything like that, like you can today. And I remember rolling down my freeway, rolling down my window on the freeway. And it was, I'd reached LA in rush hour traffic, and I said to somebody, I yelled across to their car, "Hey, which way is Santa Monica?" So it was that kind of old school trip, you know?
Yeah.
And I had $700 in my pocket when I left for gas, for everything. And a futon mattress on the car that my dad and I taped up pretty well, you know, to prevent against the weather. A batch of cassette tapes, a guitar, a Martin D28 that I still have, and my clothes. And within about a month of arriving in L.A., I met Doug Sachs. There was a job called, the title of the job was called Box Boy, which in today's world should be called Box Person, but at that time that's what they called it. And what that meant was that you would assemble the cardboard boxes that lacquers would get shipped in, because every time you cut a lacquer, it was in loose paint, you know, so you'd have to ship that out right away. So you'd have to be at the ready, and they were cutting so much vinyl in those days. It was kind of the tail end of that era, you know.
Was this an ad that you saw?
No. Through this guy that I knew, he had a crew of people, and so I sort of fell into that group, that circle of friends.
And was he a Berkeley guy?
He was not a Berkeley guy. I knew him through somebody else that was from South Africa, because that's where I'm from. So we became friends, you know. A person in that crew had applied for a job there and didn't get it, and was telling me about it, and said, you know, was, you know, respectfully handing me this info. You know, maybe you want to check it out, you know. So I went in there and unannounced. I just showed up with my resume within about 3 weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks of arriving in LA. And Doug was working, and he was floating around there, you know, and somebody had told him that I'd shown up about the job. So I figured, okay, there is a job. And so they said, well, why don't you just wait a while, you know, just hang out and he'll connect with you. So I waited maybe 2 hours, you know, in the lobby there, and kind of even got a feel for the place a little bit. He put me in his car. We drove up to the Beechwood Cafe. And I remember within seconds, my resume ended up on the floor of his car, and he had a stick shift Mustang, 5-liter, crazy horsepower car. He was really into cars. And his foot just obliterated this resume, tore it in shreds. And I tried to, you know, say, hey, you know, that's my resume over there. And he said, ah, don't worry about it. All right, it's fine. Don't worry about it. He wasn't interested in the resume.
Yeah.
So we go into Beechwood Cafe, and we chatted away, and he starts talking to me about cars and the history of LA, nothing to do with music. And he did most of the talking. And then he said, all right, if you want a job, we'll take you. $8 an hour. That was the entry level at that stage, you know. And he said, if you don't know anything, don't worry, we'll teach you. So he basically knew what he was dealing with. He was dealing with a college grad with no experience, totally green.
Did he know you're from Berkeley?
Yeah, but he didn't even care. But I think what that told him is that I was serious.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to get a degree from Berkeley and then drive out to LA, which I told him, There's somebody in front of you who kind of means business, you know.
Yeah. The reason why I bring that up, I have a very similar backstory to yours. I was a Berkeley guy, but I taught there. Actually, the recording program, I helped start the recording program, so it goes way back.
Wow, that's great. I didn't know that.
So when I came to L.A., I didn't know anybody, but one of my students said, go meet this guy. He's waiting for you. He'll help you. In Santa Monica, turns out. The only person that I didn't know, but the only connection I had in L.A. when I landed. But I was told by everybody, never tell anyone in Los Angeles that you're serious about working with, that you're from Berkeley. It was had a bad reputation.
I remember some of that.
And it was mostly because of an arrogance, I think, that a lot of the students exhibited. So I remember for a couple of years, I never said anything. But the interesting thing is, so then one day, I go to A&M where a friend of mine was an assistant. So I'm hanging with him, and he's cleaning up at the end of a session. And one of us mentioned Berkeley, and there are 9 people in the studio, and all of a sudden, ears start to perk up. And one by one, well, I went to Berkeley. I didn't know that. I went to Berkeley. And there's 7 out of the 9 people that went to Berkeley. And the only people that knew one another or knew about it was my friend and I.
Yeah.
So I think that's changed somewhat now, but
I think it's hugely changed. Yeah. And there's a guy named Peter Gordon out in LA. He's a fixture. He's been here for years, and he's done so well to gather the community.
Mm-hmm.
And the new president, Roger Brown, has been there 10 years, but he's still the new guy.
Yeah.
You know, great guy. He's really done a lot to gather the LA community and put a real sense of pride on the Berklee grads and shine a light on the some of the Berklee grad achievements, you know. So that whole thing has changed. And it's a new business now anyway. But yeah. I do remember that what you're talking about. It was kind of in the 90s that vibe permeated.
Yeah. You kept quiet about your heritage, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go back to Doug. So then you're lucky enough to get a gig with Doug Sachs. Did you understand the magnitude of that?
I could tell it, like, you know, we could tell who each other were. We understood each other very quickly. So what he saw in front of him was somebody who, you know, put in the time all the way through to get an actual degree, put all my stuff in the car, drive it to LA. So he's, like I said before, he saw somebody that meant it, you know, and I think that was enough for him. He didn't care about anything beyond that because he knew he would have to teach me everything, or somebody would have to teach me. And then what I saw in front of me, it was very evident that, you know, this was a small niche of within the industry, and there was only a few people who were at the top. And I, you know, I felt the vibe that he was, you know, the godfather. And, you know, I had done some research, although there was no internet in those days. But, you know, I knew there was one or two places in LA that were the real deal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew I was sitting in front of somebody like that. It was coming together as I was doing it, you know, that perspective on my side. It wasn't that, you know, I knew I had to go and see this guy. It started to reveal itself very, very quickly as I was in the presence of. So I think because we understood each other, we connected in that way, you know, and then found our pocket over the years.
What was the training period like?
There wasn't a training period, really. It was... For 2 years there, I was working, assembling boxes, picking up lunches, that sort of thing. You know, just entry level stuff. And then there was an engineer there who left within 2 years. And I would have been 26 at that time, no gray hair, as opposed to now, which is 50 shades of gray, maybe 60. And I said to Doug, let me do this job. And he said, no, you need some gray hair, man. You're too young. Nobody's going to trust you. Look at you. You look like a kid. And I just did not accept that. I stayed and I stayed. I just could not accept that because it was one of those things that I felt that I understood. I knew I could do it, you know.
Yeah.
I stayed there. So it's a process that I related to. So... there was never any single day in which he said, all right, you can do it. I just pushed and pushed and pushed. And eventually he let me do a little more and a little more and a little more. And then I was doing, you know, doing the work, but I hadn't been officially accepted into doing the work. It was more just like this machine that had to work. It's a small business. There was six of us there, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you an interesting story. I was in here in our studio working with Jackson Brown yesterday. Great guy, one of my favorite people in this business. In those days, the days we're talking about, when I started out, I met Jackson. I picked up sandwiches for him. That's how far we go back, 26 years. And what's interesting is, you know, every artist has a way of working, and I ended up doing a lot of work with Jackson, you know, and he was very supportive. He's an incredibly supportive guy. He's very good with youngsters getting into the industry. He makes an effort to remember your name, and he wants to know your story and everything. So, you know, as you can imagine, the artists that were floating through that time, he would take the time to really spend with me. And then I ended up doing a lot of editing with him. You know, all of this stuff that you get into on the deepest level to explore minutia, you know. And we got to know each other pretty well. And so people around the industry said, oh, well, Jackson's going to trust you. I'll trust you, you know, because I did look like the kid at the time. And, you know, I look at him as in some way responsible for me getting into the job, because people saw the confidence he put in me. He was a big star at the time, and people would notice that he would work with this young guy. You know, he still does that to this day. He does it with everybody. And what's the reason I brought him up is because I think of him in the early days like that. And coincidentally, he was in here yesterday working with me on a project that he did down in Haiti. So all these years later, we're still connected.
Yeah.
And I think that's really something, you know, when you can get into something and stay connected with a community of people over the course of that amount of time, you know, that's really something to look at. That's something that I try to put on young people and let them see.
So getting back to Doug Sachs again, did you learn by osmosis then, just by watching him?
Yeah. But I had my own, you know, I had nothing to lose at the time. So if he did something that I thought was wrong, I would just speak up. No big deal, you know. And only later did I realize I was kind of speaking up to the Godfather, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew at the time, but there wasn't anything to lose. I was hardly making any money. I was, you know, as at the beginning of my career, if it all fell apart, you know, it was early enough to do something else about it, you know. So I think, you know, it's a combination of that youthful, I don't know what the word is.
Exuberance, I guess.
Yeah,
right.
Combined with his respect for my output, you know. And he would often agree with what I said, you know. He would say, oh, okay, well, yeah, let's try that, you know. So he was taking it in. And I think when you combine all that, you get that kind of osmosis thing, you know.
Yeah.
So he wasn't the type of teacher and mentor that I try to be to the youngsters today, where it's a very calculated journey. It was more like his attitude was more like, well, if I was going to hang around, then I could just see how he does it and learn from that. And that allowed me to do things my way, to kind of get my own voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In the calculated effort, in the way that I try to do things now, which is different than that, you have to really carefully make sure that somebody ends up with their own voice. Otherwise, they could end up with your voice, you know.
Sure.
So his way was more of a guarantee of somebody finding their voice, which I did. And I still think about that, you know.
That's cool, though, that just the fact that he accepted your input.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah,
he's the Godfather. I mean, he could have said, just blend into the woodwork.
Yeah.
Be seen and not heard.
But what I learned from him in that, and from all these high-level rock stars that would come in. I mean, we dealt with, you know, when I started out, this was the record business, unlike it is today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, only a few could make records, and you had to be signed to a label and have a budget, you know. So you really got the name people on a daily basis. And so I got to know a lot of these people, and I still interact with quite a few of them. And Doug as well. Doug had his level of fame within his industry, within his circle. And what I learned from that very early is that thing that people do when you put somebody up on a pedestal or somebody's the Godfather, you know, there's kind of no such thing. I mean, you know, we're all just kind of flesh beings in this building trying to get by and get the bills paid. And if somebody's got a great idea, you know, it would be smart to hear what they have to say. So this whole, you know, this whole thing that I had in Berkeley of these unreachable rock stars got nullified pretty instantly. And you really just saw that everybody's just trying to make it through their, navigate through the world in their own way. And there's no such thing as that, you know?
Yeah. And the other thing is, what you read in the press is usually different from what the reality is. After you meet somebody and you learn their story, it's like, well, wait a second. Okay, that's distinctly different than what I thought.
Well, yeah, fake news.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. And that's why, you know, things like what you're doing here is important, because this is all the real deal, and now there's technology to expose and distribute all this information in a different way that's much more realistic, you know, and tells it how it is.
Okay, so then Doug decides to move to Oxnard, and you decide it's time to go out on your own at that point.
Yeah, you know, he was up there for a couple of years before I left, I think.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't realize he made the...
Maybe about a year.
Okay.
Maybe about a year. You know, our relationship was good. You know, we had our journey. He was my mentor. I was his protege. He was proud. I was proud. Everything was good. And then as time went on, I guess I look at my journey. You know, I'm kind of an intense personality. So I want this be secure, and I want to do this. You know, and the clients appreciate it, and the fans appreciate it because we make this music sound a certain way. So it serves that purpose. It was probably difficult for Doug to deal with, and he was an intense guy too. So you know, we're a bunch of creative people trying to get along. You know, and so he was trying to finance the Ojai operation, buy the building and set up the gear, and I was trying to custom tailor my voice in how things would sound, you know. And I found ourselves getting a little more distant in the process of that.
Mm-hmm.
So so I decided that, you know, without going into too much detail of that, I thought the cleanest thing to do was allow me to go out and do what he was doing with his life, which was setting up shop, running a business. And I had my own crew for many years, you know, before that at the lab, and they were my crew. They were loyal to me. I was their leader at the time, and they had nothing to do with Doug's side of the operation. We were separated within uh-huh. that structure. So it felt like the natural thing to do. I signed a lease and set up shop and went for it in about 2005,
okay.
I think.
So then it's actually an easier split. It's not like you jumped out on your own and then you had to build up your clientele. You already had the clients. So
yeah.
It was just setting up shop, as you would say.
Yeah, and he understood that and he supported that. You know, I thought that maybe they'd be a little nervous about following it, you know, but really the vibe was just, you know, okay, where are you now? All right, see you tomorrow, you know.
Mm.
So it was just more of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an easy, amicable split. Doug was supportive, ultimately, you know.
So when you split and started your own thing, did you find that you were busy right off the way you wanted to be, or it took some time to build up to where you wanted to get to?
No, it was always busy. I mean, I don't think we've had a single day that we haven't been booked the whole time. It's the nature of this business. Anybody doing what we do faces that. I mean, there's very few of us. And it's just always been that way, you know, before I left and since.
Yeah, okay. What did you take from Doug in terms of philosophy and approach? Because I've spoken to Doug about this myself, and I kind of know where he's coming from. I'm just curious how that relates to you.
Well, you know, we obviously see things differently, and we see things the same. You know, I'm an intense personality, so I've got my view on things. But at the same time, you have to see other perspectives and take it in. And obviously, he taught me. So in the very beginning, it was all about less is more in terms of signal processing, not only in the choices you make in creating soundscapes or sonic structures, tonal structures to music, to what you're given, but also in the equipment you use and in how the equipment's designed. Maybe one of the big important ones is, and this has actually got to do with Doug and my own journey in terms of how I discovered how to process sound on my own above and beyond what Doug taught me, you know, my own journey off to the side and figuring out where to go and creating my own sound. And that is to use several pieces of gear and a little bit of processing from each instead of using one or two things and, you know, jamming it, getting a lot out of it. Because every time you exercise these amplifiers and capacitors and electronics and that type of thing beyond what they're intended to do, when you saturate them, you get audible sound. So one of my favorite things to say is it always sounds best when it sounds like nobody was there.
Yeah.
So I can do a lot of stuff and give you a recording, and if the fan listens to it and connects to that recording and connects to that artist without realizing that somebody made it sound that way, that's really the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a flavor to it, you know, there's a sound to it, but it really should be 100% unconscious to the listener. They shouldn't think, oh, that guy, listen to that fat sound, you know, or something like that. They should just feel the energy of this recording and go right to that artist. And then their connection is between themselves and I'm out of there. And so that kind of thing I learned, you know, it was philosophically built into what that place was and what I've done ever since, you know.
You know, it's interesting, though, because the way mastering used to be was just the way you're talking, where you're trying to stay out of the way, the creative way of what was recorded, what was produced. And somewhere along the line, this kind of changed. It's changed, and I'm not saying it's better or worse, it's just changed, that now there's more of the creative aspect involved. That being said, a number of engineers, really good mixers, have said, I don't like the way that guy masters, not, you know, whatever name it is, because he changes my sound. I'm giving it to him what I liked. Yeah. It's tough in there because you have to straddle that line. How creative do you get?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up because I went about a year ago, I went around the country. We were promoting a plugin we built with IK Multimedia.
Yes, yes.
And the way we designed this plugin fits right into what you're talking about. And this is what I mean by that. So when you come in the old days when I was with Doug, the first order of business was to line up the tape machine.
Yeah.
Now, we could choose a variety of head stacks. That's one thing. Then we could choose a variety of capacitor chains, different capacitors for different head stacks. And when you combine... and then we could choose tube electronics or solid-state electronics.
Yeah.
So you'd have to spend a great deal of time figuring out how to play somebody's tape back. That's just the first order of business. And if you can imagine the amount of combinations just with what I mentioned, you would be overwhelmed. So what you have to do is you have to have a feel for what each head does, each capacitor row does, each electronic, whether it's solid-state or a tube, and how they integrate with each other. And now that relates to what the style of music is that you have coming in that day. Maybe there's a particular producer who's got a certain thing and you pick this head and that, you know. So these combinations with time, you get a feel for what these chains all are. And when you get your tape playback, you create a flat. What I mean by that is you create a curve, but it's what we would look at as a flat. Flat meaning that's our starting point.
Yes, yes.
To then which we process. But it's a curve because it has to be a curve. It's nothing other than a curve. It's never really flat. It's whatever you ended up choosing to be your thing, your flavor, so that then you could do your processing. So the processing was, you know, a touch of EQ most of the time, maybe a touch of limiting. But it was a whole bunch of work before that to get to where it was just those minimal choices made. And then you end up with a depth of field, a size, a flavor, a color. And that was what Doug was known for. And then I came into that world. So when we took our plugin, I used that same philosophy. And maybe this is even more appropriate to what you say, what philosophy did I take? What I looked at is, you know, in today's world, if you look at the settings on our console at the end of every song on every day, you'll actually see quite a lot of stuff going on. But if you really truly analyze it, it's not that far off from flat. What it is if we're dealing with a certain genre of music or a certain producer, we'll throw certain things in the chain. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I like to use a little bit of each piece of gear. So I might have three limiters in the chain, a solid state, a tube, and perhaps a de-esser for some high-frequency limiter that allows me to then EQ some high frequencies in there without it sounding screechy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use that in conjunction with the de-esser as a high-frequency limiter. You know, so I'll have a bunch of stuff cooking there that really you start to use, but it's doing the work, but not a whole lot. So in the presets in this plugin we built, you have these starting points. So if you get a hip-hop track coming in, it'll throw up the chain that we use to start that. Obviously, we're not married to that in the room. If you come in and work with us and we put up the chain, it doesn't sound good. We're going to change it. But it allows you the same luxury on the plugin. You can actually pick a chain, and without doing anything, you're going to get something out of that. And then the way it was designed is you really do a touch of EQ.
Mm.
So kind of the philosophy behind the plugin takes you back to the old school of essentially what lining up the tape machine meant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's today's version of lining up the tape machine. It's what is that chain? What is all the stuff you're going to throw on there to satisfy the client and get all the level and do all the things that's important to people in today's world?
Yeah.
And then once you've got that all sorted out, then you touch it with a bit of top end and a bit of this and a bit of that. So if you look at us work, you won't see the differentiation between all of those processes. But now that I've explained it, if you saw us work, you'd see that. And you'd look at us, evaluate the chain and go, okay, let's put a touch of this on and that, you know. I don't know if that was kind of an esoteric explanation. I don't know. I hope it made sense.
No, but I understand. But it brings up the question of what is your signal chain then?
Well, when we work in our studio, it's all analog. You know, we've slowly gotten into the world of plugins. There's some out there that can help along what we're doing, but we generally go out of a D to A. It's all files these days. Very, very little of the time it's tape anymore. So we'll D to A it, and we'll go into a couple of EQs, tube EQ, EAR. GML solid state. We'll combine those to create something, and then whatever limiters we choose from there. You know, we've got some great stuff to choose from: Manley, Fairchild, Allen Smart, SSL, Masalek. I mean, you know,
yeah, that's,
we can choose some great stuff. And
yeah,
I'd say. And then back in, you know, and
what workstation are you using to play it out?
Pro Tools. Okay. Most of the time,
yeah.
Not all the time, but that's most of the time.
And then record it back?
To Sonic Studio.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Wow. I didn't realize you were all analog like that. But
yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Because it's funny because, there's only three ways you can go. You can go, you know, all digital in the box. You can go, well, there's two ways, actually. And the other way is the hybrid, really.
Yeah.
So
we're introducing some of that. You know, we're getting, you know, sometimes if you need a little level, you know, you've got a few things that you can use to help that on your playback file.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you don't want to hit your DDA too hard, you can add file to your captured, add level to your captured file. So there's some level tools that are pretty cool. I know that UA suite is great. There's a lot of great stuff that they make.
Kidding.
So, you know, we started to incorporate that into our world a little bit too. You know, just to help things along. And if somebody wants an EQ adjustment, we're starting to look into now how maybe we can use a plugin to do that. Because there's an expectation. People don't really realize that, oh, can you just adjust this and send it back to me in 5 minutes?
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't work like that the way you work.
The way we work,
yeah.
It's not like that. You got to put up the file, redo your recall, match it up, you know, feather it in. And, you know, if you add a little top, it's not like you can just print that. You have to feather that in. It's like getting a haircut. If you want to make a slight adjustment, you have to work it in, you know.
Yeah.
So we have to pay attention to that. But we're paying attention to some of these plugins. They're getting pretty good.
I don't know if that's standard with mastering engineers, but the good ones do it like that.
You know, most of the guys out there doing it are pretty good. And when I say guys, I mean men and women.
Yeah.
I got my chops busted the other day for using the term guys, because apparently that's no longer PC. But I meant the men and women doing this job are doing a pretty good job out there. I mean, it's pretty good out there. You know, all these records coming out are, you know, have got nice sound to them. And obviously there's going to be, you know, I mean, there's a million people doing this. You can go to Guitar Center and spend $500 and do it. So there's an element of that. But I'm not sure how everybody works, but I'm aware of how some people work. And, you know, they do have a good array of choices and stuff in their chain, you know. I have noticed that.
What is the ratio between indie to label work that you do?
Well, It's all indie, really, because there's no label. So you know, we had an Elton John record, and it's an indie record. He's paying for it, you know. So it just depends how you look at it.
Okay.
Very little of the time. I mean, the labels are trying to figure out who they are right now. They're trying to figure out, you know, their own voice, their own place in the system. Most people are financing their own stuff, whether they're a big star or not. I think what you meant is who are the big stars and who are the indies and what's the ratio between that?
Yeah.
It seems to me that most of the music coming out have niche pockets. And if that's called indie or independent, then I would look at that as saying probably most music is like that, because very, very little music appeals to everybody. It's, you know, you have the big stars, you have Adele and Lady Gaga, and you have all the stuff out there. But in the scheme of things, in the amount of people making music, the amount of records being made, that's almost nothing in terms of ratio, you know. So, we've always, one of the ways I built my career early on in the early 90s, that I always wanted to be friendly towards independent bands. And the way I did that was I saw, you know, we were always billing by the hour at that time. Everybody was always nervous. They were looking at the clock on the wall. And, I wanted to take that out of the room. I wanted to get that off the table. So there was a consistency to the way we worked. I could kind of calculate what it was going to cost. You size somebody up, you know, mm-hmm. which way it's going to go, you know. So I started coming up with flat rates. Now everybody's doing flat rates, but this was very difficult to talk Doug into doing flat rates. Like, hey, Doug, come on, let me charge this much, and you come in, we do the work, and if it turns into something different, we renegotiate. But I eventually persuaded him to allow me to do flat rates for independent bands and independent labels. And people were starting to fund their own bands back then. So I developed a reputation early on as one of the first people to develop a reputation of having this, you know, stress-free environment, you mm-hmm. know. So people would tell their friends, hey, go to this person, it'll cost you this much, you know.
Yeah.
They'd be able to tell their friends what it would cost, roughly speaking. So as a result of those days, I think we're still pretty popular with independent artists, independent bands, and I've always supported that community because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, the main reason, the thing in my heart that I support there, many aspects of it, but the deepest reason is 100 years ago, if you had somebody wanting to express something on a piece of paper, they could probably do it. But if they had a song, you couldn't really capture it. There was no technology available. And then when the technology did come about, you'd have to have budgets and go through politics to get a record deal to capture your music. And you know, when I came out of school and into my professional life, it was kind of the beginning stages of people with no resources, really no connections, no political connections, no business savvy, but real artists with something to say, which is a reflection of our culture, you know.
Mm.
And I noticed on these independent records that people were actually having messages that were reflecting on the culture, you know. And so I liked the fact that the technology existed and was affordable enough that somebody could actually express themselves in music. And so I wanted to make myself available to help them with that in their tonal structures, you know, in their output. So I think just that vibe that I've brought, you know, has helped keep that community coming into us. And you know, we do a lot of big name records, but I've never really pursued that. It's really what's just happened because I was with Doug or in that environment and at that time, you know, it's just been the world I've lived in, you know, and so there's a fair amount of that and a lot of independent bands too.
Okay. Is there a consistent mixing problem that you see on the mixes that you get in? And great mixers probably won't have any problems, obviously, but there are less than great mixers. Is there a problem that you see?
It's interesting. You know, when you say there's less than great mixers, So we're living in a day and age now where some of these independent mixers are doing a bang up job. Yeah. They're doing an amazing job. It's really remarkable how well they're doing. And even the most seasoned mixers will rely on their relationships with people in my position to tell them where they're at, because a lot of times they're working on limited budgets and they're in environments unfamiliar to them. And probably the biggest single issue that comes up with the seasoned mixers or the unseasoned mixers or anybody, and they're aware of this too, is the standing bass wave.
Mm.
When you're mixing something in an environment and you're making it sound great there, and you've got something gnawing itself out, you're going to end up with an abundance in an area, and it's usually in that bass area. It's usually in that bass area because that's the build up. Yeah. That's where stuff builds up. The other frequencies don't build up as much. So I've given people some tips on how to avoid the standing wave. You know, there's some cool little tricks you can, you know, throw down blankets along the sides of your walls,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, there's fun little things to do. But that's probably the most consistent thing. And usually when it is an issue, people have some sense of it before they even come in. We talk about it before they get here.
Yeah, that makes sense, definitely. Okay, last question. You've been at this for a while, and I'm sure you've gone through a lot of business challenges in the process. So was there ever a piece of business advice that you got from somebody that was like an aha moment for you? It was like, okay, this is going to change the way I work.
No, not that I can think of, but I have been in my own senses, my own consciousness. I have doctrines that I live by. Things like consistency. You know, if you're going to come to me and you sold your mom's jewelry and you got $100 and you got 20 songs, you know, I mean, it's hard to get us to agree to do that kind of work. But if we take it in, we have to give you the same treatment that we're going to give anybody else.
Yeah.
And anybody who works on our crew needs to understand that. You know, there's one way that you can do something. And when you have that sense of consistency, the world gets to know you in that, because they see you. And I think in my experience, when I've seen people go, oh, well, it's you, so I'm going to operate this way, and I'm going to operate a different way for this person, they tend to have a much shorter lifespan in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
So consistency is a crucial aspect. And it's not just for selfish purposes of that. There's something greatly satisfying about being consistent. It promotes a sense of self. It's a meditation. Because it allows you to live in that moment, you know,
yeah,
all the time. You are that person. That is who you identify with being. So it's on a deeper personal level that you know, straddles the professional life as well. The other thing is, it's you have to pay attention to the give-take cycle. You know, there's people in life that are just takers. How much can I get? You know, and you know, there's people that are just givers, and that's unsustainable as well. I think what you have to do is pay attention to the cycle of releasing and receiving, and you know, information, money, equipment, whatever it is that's coming into your life. You kind of have to balance it with what's going out of your life. And what that's going to do is it's going to keep you in the community. So where I relate that philosophy is in my volunteer work. And I do a lot of my work through the Recording Academy.
Yeah.
I've been a governor on the board there for 3 terms so far. I'm about to end my third term. I have to sit out for a 1-year span, I think, because... you know, they got to mix it up there.
Term limits, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm on a few committees in there, and I usually try to get myself involved in the P&E wing committees,
yeah,
and in the committees that give back to youth, generally college-age people getting into this business. And what I like to get from that is I like to be in the community. That's my only expectation. And I like to give my knowledge to the youngsters, not because there's no one singular reason for that. It's multi-tiered. One is because in my heart, I want to give what I've learned back into the system. But also, to receive, I want to live in a world where I'm, you know, people are doing decent work.
Yeah, sure.
I want to get something from that as well. I want to give this knowledge so that we're living in a world where, you know, things are good. So there's receiving reasons for that and giving reasons for that. And it's always looking at that cycle. I think that's important. And I think interacting with one's community, staying in the community, knowing why you're doing it, and understanding a strategy behind that is a very important part of being successful in your line of work, whatever your community, whatever your industry is.
Excellent advice.
For more info on Gavin and Lursen Mastering, go to lursenmastering.com, LURSSEN Mastering, all one word, lursenmastering.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOwnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOwnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.